Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're really plunging into the world of the Kurdish Dengbej tradition. It's this incredibly ancient, really vital form of oral culture.
Absolutely.
And the material we've got to explore today is just, well, incredibly rich. So we're looking forward to digging in, you know, seeing what makes this tradition tick.
Definitely. The sources, they offer such a remarkable window, don't they? Right into the narratives, the collective memory. It's really the heart of Kurdish society in many ways.
So our mission then is to get a handle on what Dengbej is, its history, why it still resonates.
Exactly. Think of it like uncovering layers, you know, layers of a living historical record.
Okay, let's start with the name itself, Dengbej.
Yeah.
It seems packed with meaning.
It really is. It
comes from Kurmanji Kurdish, right? Deng is voice, sound, even news, and bej is to say or tell.
Precisely. And that dual meaning of deng, voice, and news, that's really key, I think.
So it's more than just singing. It's about conveying stories, information, news.
Yeah, exactly. These dengbej weren't just artists in the modern sense. They were vital communicators. You have to imagine a time before, you know, widespread literacy or mass media.
Right.
They were essential, sharing history, but also what was happening then.
Okay, so who were these dengbej? The sources describe them as, like, singer-poets, storytellers who sang.
That's a good way to put it. Singer poets, singing storytellers.
And the repertoire sounds huge.
Oh.
Epic poems, destan, historical accounts, legends, love stories, war stories.
Lullabies, laments, the kilim or strong. Yeah, it's a whole tapestry of human experience, really.
And traditionally, they were often itinerant, moving between villages.
Many were, yes, especially during the long winter evenings. They'd perform in guest rooms, the Diwan or Oda.
Hosted by prominent families, it says. Sounds like a real social hub.
It was a center for cultural exchange.
And compensation wasn't always money, was it? The sources mention food, lodging, protection.
That's right. It points to a more traditional sort of reciprocal system. Their art was valued, supported through basic needs.
But it went way beyond just entertainment.
Oh, absolutely. With written Kurdish literature often limited or even suppressed.
Right.
The Dengbej became the primary, well, the keepers of collective memory. History, cultural narratives, everything was passed down through them.
Living libraries.
That's a great term for it. Or living archives, historians, journalists of their time. The sources use all these phrases.
Yeah, those really jumped out.
Yeah.
And these two main song forms, kilam and stran.
Mm-hmm.
Kilam seems more like recital, epic, non-strophic, almost like spoken word with melody.
Kind of, yeah. Free rhythm, often narrative driven.
And stran more song-like, melodic, rhythmic.
Generally, yes. More structured, maybe more for emotional expression or shorter tales. It suggests a real sophistication in how they use their art.
Let's talk history. The roots seem incredibly deep.
They really do.
Some scholars link Dengbej back to ancient Indo-European bards. Even Parthian storytellers, the Ghassan.
It's a lineage that suggests this fundamental human need for oral storytelling, for passing culture through voice. It stretches back centuries, possibly a millennia.
And the comparison, someone like Evdalih Zanike gets to Homer. That's mentioned by Yasir Kemal and others.
Yes, and that's not just a casual thing. It's a very deliberate comparison.
To highlight the epic scope. The foundational importance.
Exactly. It's saying, look, our oral tradition stands alongside the great epics of the world. It elevates the cultural weight, especially, you know, in contexts where it might have been dismissed.
That makes sense. A strategic claim for its value.
Mm.
We also see hints of Kurdish musicians earlier, Umayyad and Abbasid periods.
Mm-hmm. There are mentions.
And even female Dengbej carrying a Dengbej in 11th century Marwanid courts.
Right. Which is fascinating. It shows this isn't some recent thing, and maybe not always exclusively male, even that far back. It's woven deep into the history.
So fundamentally, it's been a lifeline for Kurdish identity, language, culture, especially against assimilation pressures.
Absolutely vital. A way to hold on to the past, assert continuity, like the sources say, the autobiography of society.
That phrase is so powerful. And more recently, say the last few decades, this formal recognition, this heritagization.
Yes, that's a key shift. Framing Dengbej explicitly as Kurdish cultural heritage.
Which sounds positive, but maybe complex.
It is complex. It's partly about preservation and recognition, which is important, but it also happens in a specific political context, you know? It becomes a symbol used in asserting identity, sometimes navigating state narratives about culture.
Right. We'll probably come back to that. But how did someone become a Dengbeji? It wasn't just picking up a guitar.
No, definitely not. The sources describe this really rigorous apprenticeship.
Years under a master, memorizing tons of material, absorbing style.
Exactly. A deep immersion, learning the repertoire, the vocal techniques, the performance codes, the whole spirit of it. It sounds incredibly demanding.
Like a dedicated schooling, almost.
In a way, yes. But it wasn't just rote learning, either. The best Dengbej had fidelity to the tradition, sure, but also creative adaptation. They had to connect.
And the performance style, mostly a cappella. The voice is everything.
That's the defining characteristic, really, the unaccompanied human voice. It requires incredible skill modulation, ornamentation, power, pure emotional expression through sound.
Wow.
Instruments like the tambour are mentioned, maybe more in Mardin or more recently.
Right.
But the Serhat region, a real heartland for this, emphasizes that unadorned voice.
For the lack of instruments isn't a lack, it's a focus, a strength.
Precisely. All the focus is on the voice's power. And those traditional performances in the Oda or Diwan, yeah, they sound so intimate.
Communal events, right, with etiquette, specific seating, audience interaction. Performances could last for hours.
Yes, very much embedded in the social life. A real contrast to, say, a modern concert stage or even the Dengbej houses we see now.
Which brings us to some key figures, these voices of the past and present. Evdali Zanike, first the Homer of the Kurds.
A truly legendary figure, late 19th, early 20th century. Serhat region.
Possibly blind. Master of epic storytelling.
That's the tradition. His status is almost mythical. And again, that Homer comparison, it signals his foundational role in shaping Kurdish epic narrative. He set a standard.
Then Shakiro, who died much more recently, 1996, a modern master.
Yes, also from Serhat, though he lived in Izmir later. He's remembered for this incredibly powerful, emotive voice.
His repertoire scene is a Kurdish history archive.
Absolutely. His recordings circulated widely, even underground during times of suppression. They were hugely important for preservation. He became a benchmark for younger Dengbej.
And Karapetis Gaso, an ethnic Armenian Dengbej.
Yes, which is so important. It highlights the multicultural reality of the region.
Master of classic Kurdish kilims. Worked with Radio Yerevan.
He did. A long career. Radio Yerevan's Kurdish service was crucial for preserving and disseminating Dengbeji, especially when it was difficult within Turkey. His story speaks volumes about shared culture.
And then Ayşe Şan, a prominent woman Dengbej, queen of sorrowful song.
A fascinating and important figure. From Diyarbakır, lived in Iraq, Germany. Her voice was incredibly emotive, often singing about exile, loss, Xeribi.
She blended traditional and modern elements. Challenge gender norms.
She really did. A pioneer in a male-dominated field. Her life and music became iconic, reflecting both Kurdish struggles and women's struggles.
And the sources list others, Reso Mehmetin Ninyasi.
Reso from Mursh, known for his deep knowledge. Mehmetin Ninyasi, illiterate but with this vast memorized repertoire, part of the Dengbej House Project.
A real memory carrier.
Exactly. And Merida Kinney, known for humor, even erotic themes, showing the breadth. Kazo, Hussein Fer, Sait Sain Boyakshi, documented by people like Hilmi Akyol.
It paints a picture of a really rich landscape of voices.
Definitely. Many individuals shape this tradition.
Okay, let's dive into the actual content. The themes, the narrative, the music itself. The themes seem to cover everything.
Pretty much the whole spectrum of life, yeah.
Love and romance, passion, elopement, separation, even interfaith relationships and erotic themes.
Yes, love is a huge theme, often from female perspectives, too, which is interesting. And Murat Akinay, as mentioned, brought in humor and eroticism.
Then heroism, war, rebellion, celebrating resistance, but also reflecting a sort of local Kurdish political geography.
Right. The epics often deal with local leaders, resistance against outside forces. State borders are often portrayed as, you know, impositions on this landscape.
And history, social commentary, chronicling events, migrations, massacres, daily life. Even Kurdish disunity sometimes.
Absolutely. Providing that vernacular history, the view from within the community, often contrasting with official narratives.
Nature and geography seem pervasive too.
The Kurdish landscape isn't just a backdrop, it's almost a character, a source of metaphor, maybe melody, defining home versus exile.
And sorrow, lament, mourning. The Zeribi exile seems a potent theme.
Deeply potent, expressing both personal and collective grief. Mythology and legend, too, transmitting older beliefs.
And the narrative styles. We have the long epics needing huge memory.
Yes, incredible feats of memorization.
but also improvisation within the tradition, adapting, adding contemporary references.
Yes, that balance is key. Keeping it alive, not just reciting fossils.
Emotive, direct delivery, embodying characters.
Very much so. A direct emotional pipeline to the audience.
And using formulaic language, structures, vivid descriptions to help memory and performance.
These are classic features of oral traditions globally, yes. They aid the teller and the listener.
Musically, we know the voice is primary.
Absolutely central.
But we have the distinction between the free rhythm, maybe more ornamented coelom.
Melismatic, yes. Lots of notes per syllable sometimes.
And the more regular, perhaps strophic strand.
Right. More song-like structure.
And distinctive vocal techniques.
Mm-hmm.
Ornamentation, glottal stops, powerful timbres.
All contribute to that unique sound. High volume was historically important too, before amplification. And that handcuff-to-ear posture.
Right. Partly practical, partly performance tradition.
Likely both, yeah. Focusing the sound, signaling the performance. Regional variations exist too, like we said about Martin maybe using instruments more than Serhat.
And some even felt the melodies came from nature, inspired by the landscape.
That's perceived connection mentioned in the sources, yeah. This deep link between the music and the environment.
Okay, this next part feels incredibly important. Their role as guardians during suppression.
Crucial, absolutely crucial, especially in Turkey.
Preserving the Kurdish language, Kurmanji, when its public use was severely restricted.
Think about it. If you can't write it, publish it, teach it, the oral tradition becomes the lifeline. Dengbej kept the vocabulary, the grammar, the nuances alive just by singing.
Modern Kurdish intellectuals acknowledge this role.
Yes, very much so. They see Dengbej as having played a vital part in language survival.
And chronicling unofficial history, keeping that community perspective alive against state narratives.
Exactly. Recording events, migrations, daily struggles from a Kurdish viewpoint. Maintaining a collective memory that might otherwise be erased.
Sustaining identity, just listening, performing. It reinforced shared heritage.
Absolutely. It was a collective ritual. Even songs that weren't overtly political helped, just by using the language, reflecting the worldview.
But it came at a huge cost. The risks. Harassment, fines, arrest.
Imprisonment, torture.
The sources are clear on this. It was dangerous work, especially after the 1980 coup.
Performances went underground. Secret recordings.
Yes, it retreated into private spaces. Mm-hmm. Even when restrictions eased somewhat in the 90s, fear, self-censorship, these remained real issues. There was always the risk of performances being allowed, but, you know, sanitized, stripped of their deeper meanings.
Their persistence was an act of courage.
Immense courage.
Which leads into the more recent politicization and heritageization we touched on.
Yeah.
As Kurdish culture gained more public space.
Right. In the late 20th, early 21st centuries, Dengbeji becomes more explicitly embraced as a symbol.
By Kurdish political parties, municipalities, supporting Dengbej houses, performances. Yes. It's seen as representing national identity, resilience against assimilationist narratives. Though, interestingly, there was maybe some initial ambivalence from nationalists about the local focus in many traditional songs.
Ah, right. The tension between local loyalty and national unity.
Exactly. And this framing as cultural heritage.
The double-edged sword again.
It asserts value, helps preservation, potentially attracts funding. But it can also be framed as sort of non-political folklore, fitting into state-approved multiculturalism, perhaps.
Potentially downplaying the resistance aspect.
It's a complex negotiation. Who gets to define the tradition? What parts are emphasized? It's politically charged.
And it brings up those tensions the sources highlight. Patronage versus popular voice historically. Who do they speak for?
It's complex. They often relied on powerful patrons, but their songs also resonated deeply with ordinary people. They could reflect both elite and folk perspectives, sometimes simultaneously.
National unity versus local realities, where you mentioned that.
A key tension when a tradition rooted in specific places becomes a national symbol.
And authenticity versus adaptation. How do you preserve it while letting it live and breathe? Using recordings, instruments, new venues.
These are the big questions. Some performers, especially women mentioned in the sources, try to practice it as culture separate from politics, as a way to navigate these pressures.
So where does that leave Dengbeji today? Is it thriving, fading, evolving?
Well, it's definitely continuing, evolving, and inspiring people, largely thanks to these revival efforts.
The Mala Dengbejan. The Dengbej houses in Van Diyarbakir.
Yes, supported by municipalities, external funding sometimes. They provide spaces to perform, share knowledge, mentor younger singers.
And crucially, documentation. recording songs, life stories, transcribing legacies like Hilmi Akyol's work.
Exactly. Trying to capture this vast knowledge before the older generation passes. Plus, increased visibility at festivals on TV channels like TRT Kirti.
So it's shifting from a purely organic tradition to something more managed, institutionalized.
To some extent, yes. Which has pros and cons.
And modern interpretations are happening too.
Oh, yeah. Modern Kurdish musicians Delil Dilanar, Rojda, are mentioned, reinterpret old kilams with new instruments, mix in archive recordings. Dengbej vocal styles influence other music.
And it influences literature, too. Mehmet Uzun, Mehmet Dikul.
Yes. There's a broader trend of collecting oral texts, valuing that heritage in written forms, too. And academia is paying more attention, ethnomusicology, anthropology, Kurdish studies.
So there's life in it yet. But challenges remain.
Significant challenges. The number of elderly masters is dwindling. Many live in poverty.
And attracting young people. Is it hard?
It can be. Disconnect with the style, the themes, sometimes the language dialect. Competition from global pop culture is huge. The traditional social context, the Oda performances, are less common.
And political instability. The destruction of the Diyarbakir Dengbej house is mentioned.
Yes, that was a major blow. The political situation always casts a shadow, so the future is uncertain.
But there's hope. Young performers, including women, taking it on as a responsibility.
There is hope. Dedicated individuals see it as vital cultural work. It suggests the tradition might transform, find new relevance, new perspectives, rather than just disappear. It's this dual path preservation and creative adaptation.
Okay, so to wrap up this deep dive.
Yeah.
We've seen the Dengbej as these masters of the voice, true living archives.
Preservers of language, history. Navigating immense challenges.
Leaving behind this incredibly powerful art form.
Absolutely. It's a testament to the resilience of oral culture, its power to sustain identity against the odds.
And maybe a final thought for our listeners. In our own world, often swamped by digital noise, what's the value of the human voice carrying stories? What can the Dengbej teach us about resilience? And maybe what responsibility do we have to listen to the voices of memory in our own communities?
That's a great question to ponder. How do we value and preserve those voices?
Thank you for joining us today as we explore the rich world of the Kurdish Dengbej.